Chapter 10. Growing Mold Cultures. Many people are disturbed by the notion of eating molds, yet microscopic molds are inevitably present on much of our food, and certain molds have long traditions of use by people who grow them on foods as a means of processing. In the West, the most familiar mold ferments are cheeses, though molded cheeses do not seem to hold universal appeal. Most Westerners still have a deep-seated prejudice against moldy products, and they generally associate the word mold with food spoilage, as in moldy bread, observe William Shurtleff and Akiko Aoyagi. In Asia, molds are used much more widely and have greater acceptance. The word mold there has a rather positive connotation, something like yeast in the West, write Shurtleff and Aoyagi. Mixed cultures, including yeasts and bacteria, but typically dominated by molds grown on grains, transliterated from Chinese as chu, or jui chu, or da chu, have been used in Asia for thousands of years. There is no exact English equivalent for chu, writes H.T. Huang. It has been translated variously as barm, leaven, yeast, and starter. None is entirely satisfactory, but ferment is probably the best we can do since chu contains both enzymes and live organisms. During incubation, the enzymes hydrolyze the starch from the grain, the spores germinate, and the mycelii proliferate to produce more amylases. The yeasts grow in number and ferment the sugars generated in situ, in place, to alcohol. The procedure has been called amylomyces, or simply amylo process. Chu and related cultures typically contain some combination of molds, including Aspergillus, Rhizopus, Mucor, and/or Monascus, along with yeasts and bacteria, traditionally derived from the environment, often via plant material. H.T. Huang points out that the form of chu as a solid cake or brick gives rise to different environmental niches in the cake itself that flavor different molds. Conditions in the interior of the cake tend to favor the growth of the Rhizopus species, while those on the surface of the Aspergillus species. The differing characteristics of these distinct mold populations were observed and noted long ago. Shurtleff and Aoyagi explain that by the 6th century CE, Chinese documents distinguished between two types of molds. What we now call Aspergillus was then called yellow robe, and Rhizopus was called white robe. These cultures were carefully distinguished and propagated from year to year. Japanese koji, used to make sake, miso, soy sauce, and other ferments, consists of various substrates grown with a yellow robe mold, Aspergillus or Rhizi. Javanese tempeh, in contrast, is grown with a white robe mold, Rhizopus oligosporus. From the fermentation of rice and millet-based alcoholic beverages, chu use grew to incorporate wheat and other grains, vegetables, fish, meat, soybeans, and other substrates. Although the mold ferment was developed originally for making wine, further exploitation of its activities soon paved the way to the production of an array of fermented foods, which have helped to shape the character and flavor of the Chinese diet and cuisine, explains Huang. Chu use also spread throughout Asia. With the advent of microbiology in the late 19th century, microbiologists began to take note of the interesting preparations of mixed cultures. Isolating individual molds and using them in new ways the ancient Chinese could not have possibly dreamed of when they discovered a way to prepare a stable culture of grain molds more than 4,000 years ago. In our time, enzymes from chu-derived molds are used extensively in food processing, including the manufacture of high-fructose corn syrup, distilling, biofuels, and many other industries. The genome sequence of A. oryzae has revealed striking mobility, according to the journal Bioscience, Biotechnology, and Biochemistry. It is a treasure house of enzymes and metabolites. According to Steinkraus, more than 50 different enzymes have been found in koji. This treasure house need not be the exclusive domain of professional biotechnologists. Molds can be extremely rewarding to work with, and they are simple and safe to grow at home. The environmental requirements of molds are somewhat different from most other ferments, however. In order to grow, molds need oxygen. This makes them aerobic. Most ferments, yeasts, and lactic acid bacteria are anaerobic. For biologists, this is a defining characteristic of fermentation. Aerobic fermentation is an oxymoron, strictly speaking. Or maybe more accurately, a paradox, because chew, as well as tempeh, vinegar, kombucha, and countless other aerobic processes are widely understood to be fermentations. Molds need oxygen, but not too much of it, moisture, but not too much of it, and heat, but not too much of it. Compared with most other fermentations, they are rather persnickety. The people who discovered these processes long ago found by chance conditions favorable for the appropriate fungi to grow, writes C.W. Heseltine. With some basic insights into these conditions and a little creative ingenuity, anyone can create appropriate incubation conditions in a home kitchen. Microorganisms in My Bed, a poem by Kilo, March 2008, Urbana. Top drawer ferments, incubate, pearl barley, dusty white, sweet earth rot, under wrap. In old linens off dinner tables everywhere, 95 degrees Fahrenheit, constant. Soft skin curls around, terry cloth, plump heart packed tight. I want rot to bloom audibly, in star-flung quiet nights, eat the past, digest, act from now, backed up by bacterial millions. Incubation chambers for growing molds. The biggest technical challenge for growing koji, tempeh, chu, or other Asian culinary molds, unless you are lucky enough to have a sustained ambient climate of roughly 80 to 90 degrees Fahrenheit or 27 to 32 degrees Celsius with high humidity, is to simulate those conditions in some sort of incubation chamber. Modestly warm temperatures like this hasten mold growth. Molds also require oxygen, so rather than relying solely on air movement blocking insulation to maintain temperatures, as described in Chapter 3, it usually works best to incorporate into the incubation chamber greater airflow, along with a low-level heat source. But watch out! If temperatures get much warmer than the target range, the molds can be killed, and Bacillus subtilis, the slimy natto bacterium, will typically be ready to develop. Note that these conditions are required only for growing the molds, not for using them. You can use chu to make rice beer or use koji to make miso without such exacting requirements. But growing the molds that constitute these starters requires optimal temperature and humidity conditions. The following are several different improvisational incubation methods I have used or encountered. Oven method. Kitchen ovens are insulated chambers that can easily be adapted to this use. The oven is designed to maintain temperatures much higher than the mold growing range, but the chamber itself can also be used to maintain more moderate heat. Most contemporary ovens have an illuminating light that can be switched on. In my oven, simply switching on the light heats the oven to a perfect 90 degrees Fahrenheit or 32 degrees Celsius. I use a thermometer in the oven to monitor the temperature and turn off the light or prop the door open a bit to adjust the temperature if it gets too warm. Gas ovens with pilot lights can also be used as incubation chambers. Do not turn the oven on at all. Rather, use the pilot light itself as the source of heat. Typically, with the door closed, an oven with a pilot light will maintain a temperature higher than 90 degrees Fahrenheit or 32 degrees Celsius. How high depends on the size of the flame, which can be adjusted easily on most ovens. Well before whatever you are preparing is ready for incubation, place a thermometer inside the oven. The ideal thermometers for this are those with remote readouts, some designed for cooking meat, others for reading outdoor temperatures, because you can read them without having to open the oven door and thereby alter the temperature. Still, you can also make do with whatever thermometer may be at hand. Place the thermometer inside the closed oven. Leave it for at least 15 minutes and read the temperature. If it's higher than 90 degrees Fahrenheit or 32 degrees Celsius, turn down the pilot light if possible. Otherwise, prop the oven door open with any small item. I like to use mason jar rings. Leave for another 15 minutes and check the temperature again. If it's still too high, the door needs to be propped open more, using something bigger. If the oven is now too cool, a temperature below 85 degrees Fahrenheit or 30 degrees Celsius, it needs less of an opening. Try propping the door with a wooden spoon or a piece of cardboard. Adjust the oven opening until the temperature is just right and continue to monitor periodically during incubation. If your oven has neither pilot nor interior light, or the light does not generate sufficient heat, you can place a bare, low-wattage incandescent bulb in a simple fixture at the bottom of the oven. Place a ceramic trivet or a pan of water above the light bulb to diffuse the heat and protect the ferment from a hot spot where the mold is killed by excessive heat. Check the temperature after it has heated up for a while, and prop the door open if the temperature climbs beyond the desired range. With the oven method, the dry heat, whether its source is a pilot light or a light bulb, can quickly dry out the substrate such that the mold cannot develop. Therefore, it is imperative to take measures to prevent the ferment from drying out. The typical improvisation to accomplish this for tempeh is to contain the inoculated beans in a plastic bag dotted with tiny holes. The plastic keeps most of the humidity in while the holes allow for needed air circulation. This simulates the banana leaves that are traditionally used in Indonesia to contain tempeh. Making koji, the grain is typically wrapped in breathable fabric that protects it from drying out quickly. Specific wrappings will be detailed as we cover each ferment. One final note for incubating in the oven. Cover the oven controls with masking tape or a note so that you or whomever you live with does not inadvertently turn on the oven and destroy your ferment with high heat. Aquarium heater method. This method requires more in the way of special equipment, but it offers the advantage of being self-regulating. The equipment you need is 1. A thermostatically controlled aquarium heater with heat settings up to about 88 degrees Fahrenheit or 31 degrees Celsius. 2. A hotel pan or other deep, at least 2 inches or 5 centimeters, baking dish that can float in water, and 3. A plastic storage tub with a top, big enough to accommodate the pan, which floats on water inside it. Fill the storage tub with water to 4 to 6 inches, 10 to 15 centimeters, deep. Place the heater at the bottom of the tub and plug into an electrical outlet. Set it at roughly 88 degrees Fahrenheit or 31 degrees Celsius. After the water has heated for a while, confirm the temperature with the thermometer and adjust the heater as necessary. Place the pan with inoculated substrate to float in water. The temperature of the water will maintain the temperature of the substrate floating in it. The top of the storage tub should have a towel wrapped around it to absorb condensation before it drips onto developing mold. The top needs to be placed slightly askew. Its presence prevents evaporation, but gaps at the edges guarantee good air circulation, which would be impeded by fitting the top tightly in place. I learned of this method from Santa Cruz, California, tempeh aficionado Manfred Warmoth, who has posted online a PowerPoint presentation on the method. Temperature controller. With a temperature controller, an incandescent light bulb incubation setup can be self-regulating. Using such a device, I plug the heat source light bulb into the temperature controller, set for 87 degrees Fahrenheit or 30 degrees Celsius, situated at the top of the incubation chamber. The light stays on until the thermostat reaches the target temperature, then the bulb switches off until the thermostat senses that the temperature has cooled, when it turns on again. A self-regulating system is convenient because it does not require as much monitoring as one that you must manually regulate. Dedicated incubator designs. The incubator I use these days is a defunct commercial refrigerator equipped with an incandescent light bulb and a thermostat to regulate it. The only other modifications I made were to drill a few extra holes near the bottom of the fridge to encourage air circulation. The fridge was already vented on top. I have seen similar setups in styrofoam insulated boxes and insulated beverage coolers. If you grow large amounts of mold cultures in a small chamber, be sure to monitor it frequently during the second half of its process, when the mold growth begins to produce heat. If not adequately ventilated, heat can accumulate and kill the mold. Some inventive tempeh makers have solved this problem by expanding their chambers, so the heat produced by a large mass of tempeh can easily dissipate. Kaylin Larson took the aquarium heater incubation system a step further, situating a rack inside a modified indoor greenhouse above the heated water, creating a much larger incubation space. Manfred, who first showed me the aquarium heater incubator design, also uses a thermostat with a space heater and a fan in a closet or bathroom to create a larger incubation chamber. "I can make huge amounts if I set up a rack in the closet," he writes. An internet search of tempeh incubator design will yield many designs, schematic diagrams, and photographs for inspiration. Bakers with rising or proofing chambers can usually use those. I've also heard of people using heating pads and hot water bottles as heat sources. Favero Green Forest of Seattle, Washington writes, I have a radiant heated floor which is a perfect place to incubate. No single incubation system or design is the best. They all have advantages and disadvantages. I would encourage experimentalists to work with resources at hand and refine your system if you find yourself growing mold cultures frequently or in larger quantities. Making tempeh. The first mold I learned to make was tempeh, sometimes called tempeh, from the Indonesian island of Java. Tempeh is made by growing molds, predominantly Rhizopus oligosporus, usually on soybeans. The mold pre-digests them, binds them together, and greatly reduces required cooking time. Fresh tempeh is truly delicious, vastly superior to what is typically available commercially. Although tempeh is best known as a soybean ferment, it can be made from any combination of legumes and/or grains, and other substrates as well. For years I thought that some legumes were necessary, but my friend and helper Spikey, an irrepressible experimentalist, insisted on trying a batch of all-grain millet oat tempeh, with no legume whatsoever. And it not only worked, but was quite delicious, lighter than soy tempeh and almost nutty. I typically make tempeh that is half legumes and half grains. My longtime familiarity with tempeh is due to its popularity in Western vegetarian subcultures. 40 years ago, in the early 1970s, the hippies at The Farm, a community in Tennessee, were trying to figure out how to feed themselves on a vegan diet. They grew soybeans and set up a soy dairy, making soy milk and tofu. In their quest to learn about how different traditions processed soybeans into food, they heard about tempeh, obtained cultures from the USDA Culture Collection, and started not only making tempeh, but also writing and teaching about how to make it, producing spores, and retailing the spores with detailed directions. A great deal of the credit for introducing tempeh to the American public goes to The Farm, write Shurtleff and Aoyagi. And indeed, when I first attempted to make tempeh, the starter I used came from the tempeh lab at The Farm. Tempeh starter is a culture of mold spores, the reproductive agents of fungi, akin to seeds from plants. You can over-ripen tempeh so that it matures to sporulation and propagate starter. Or you can purchase tempeh starter, usually in the form of mold spores mixed with a powdered grain substrate. There are a growing number of commercial sources of tempeh starter. It is possible to make tempeh without a starter per se, but from a piece of fresh live tempeh. I emphasize that this method requires tempeh that is fresh, because most commercial tempeh is pasteurized and then often frozen for greatest stability. But if you can obtain fresh live tempeh, mince it finely and mix about 10% mature tempeh into cooked, cooled, dried ingredients. The mycelium continues its rapid growth without the use of spores, explained Shurtleff and Aoyagi. Tempeh made with this starter, however, generally has a slightly weaker mycelium and the incubation time is a little longer than for tempeh made with starter from the sporulation methods. And remember that there are always some unwanted bacteria in the original tempeh. If you are careless and/or if the humidity is high, their numbers will increase with each generation until eventually they prevail, preventing the formation of good tempeh. Once you have some starter, you need to prepare the beans and/or grains that will serve as the substrate for the mold, which will bind the beans and grains into blocks of tempeh. If you are working with soybeans, the first step is to dehull them. Soybean hulls, like the hulls of some other beans, such as chickpeas, are formidable barriers. If the beans remain encased in their thick hulls, the mold we are trying to grow on the beans cannot access their protein-rich flesh. Cracking the beans causes the hulls to fall off the beans. I usually crack the beans dry before soaking using a simple hand grinder set with the burrs about 1/4 inch or 1/2 centimeter apart, so that each bean gets broken in 2 or more pieces, but they do not get crushed into a powder. The traditional method is to pour boiling water over the beans and leave them to soak overnight in the cooling water. Once cool, the hulls fall off with gentle rubbing or kneading. Generally, people actively seek to remove the fallen soybean hulls, either from the dry beans by shaking cracked beans and blowing away the husks that rise to the top, or by skimming them with a strainer or slotted spoon as they rise to the surface of the water. But this is not a functional necessity. Removed from the beans, the hulls do not impede development of the mold, and they add fiber and bulk to the tempeh. Traditionally, beans for tempeh are always soaked prior to cooking. Although this step is not absolutely necessary, it is beneficial to the process and to the finished product. Steinkraus writes, under natural conditions in the tropics, tempeh production involves two distinct fermentations. The first being a 24-hour soak, which is bacterial and results in acidification of the beans. This acidification, to the range of pH 4.5 to 5.3, does not affect the mold growth, but it does prevent the development of undesirable bacteria that might spoil the tempeh. A team of microbiologists studying the possible importance of tempeh soaking observed that previous research has focused mostly on the stage of fungal fermentation by Rhizopus oligosporus. Yet the acidifying preliminary fermentation is emerging as an important event in the control of tempeh quality. Another group of researchers concluded that mainly lactic acid bacteria are responsible for this acidification, leading to better growth conditions for the mold and suppression of contamination or toxin production. As in so many ferments, the bacterially produced acids protect against potentially pathogenic bacteria. In this case, even though cooking the beans kills the bacteria themselves, the acids they created continue to create an advantageous selective environment for growth of the desired molds. In temperate climates, simple soaking will not lead to as rapid acidification as in tropical climates. The study quoted above found that sufficient acidic fermentation to lower the pH of the beans to 4.5 took three times as long at 68 degrees Fahrenheit or 20 degrees Celsius, 36 hours, as it did at 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit or 37 degrees Celsius. Most of the Western approaches to making tempeh have substituted vinegar for the traditional pre-fermentation. William Shurtleff and Akiko Aoyagi in The Book of Tempeh recommend adding vinegar to cooking water, 1 1/2 tablespoons or 25 milliliters vinegar to 10 cups, 2.5 liters, water for 1 pound or 500 grams beans. The Farm's tempeh recipe eliminates altogether the step of soaking beans and calls instead for acidifying them by adding vinegar at a proportion of 2 tablespoons of vinegar per pound of dry soybeans, directly to cooked beans immediately prior to inoculation. If you do that, be sure to distribute vinegar thoroughly before adding starter. Betty Steckmeyer, co-founder of Gem Cultures, decided to leave vinegar out of the process in the directions that accompanied the starter she made and sold. My experimentation goes back almost 30 years when I was writing my original tempeh making directions, recounts Betty. I was using the Farm Vegetarian Cookbook, which uses added vinegar on the cooked beans before inoculation. Once I forgot it, the pre-measured vinegar was there on the counter after the tempeh was in the incubator, and found no difference in the tempeh. I repeated with less inoculum and no vinegar, still good. For years I made tempeh by Betty's method, without soaking or adding vinegar, with fine results. Only after reading Steinkraus's description of tempeh as two distinct fermentations did I realize that soaking could be significant. Sometimes soaking 36 to 48 hours is not a problem. You can also speed the water soak fermentation by doing it in the heat of the incubation chamber and/or by culturing it with sauerkraut juice, sourdough starter, whey, or other live lactic acid bacteria cultures. A key to making tempeh is undercooking the beans. For soybeans, this means boiling them for about 45 minutes, until they are soft enough to bite through, but not as soft as you would want them for eating, when they begin to collapse and lose their shape. If beans are too well cooked, then the space between the beans, where oxygen circulates and the mold can develop, is eliminated. Therefore, it is imperative to cook the beans only partially. Most beans require much shorter cooking times than soybeans. Many beans require only 5 to 10 minutes of boiling to prepare for tempeh. Red lentils take barely a minute. Monitor beans closely, drain as soon as they are soft enough to bite through and definitely before they begin to collapse and lose their shape. Next, the beans need to be dried and cooled. Cooked beans are coated with water, and this free water encourages bacterial growth rather than the desired molds. Keith Steinkraus summarizes various traditional methods of drying the beans to remove this excess water. The Malaysians surface dry the beans by rolling them in a piece of cloth prior to inoculation. Some manufacturers also coat the beans with wheat flour, which absorbs any excess moisture. The Indonesians frequently spread the boiled beans on flat woven bamboo trays. Excess water trickles through the bottom of the tray, and the surfaces of the bean cotyledons become dry as the beans cool. In wild fermentation, I recommended drying beans with a towel to absorb surface moisture. what Steinkraus identifies as the Malaysian method, which is fine if you're working at a small scale, but becomes more cumbersome as you scale up production. An easier way to dry beans is with a fan. Aim the fan right at the beans and stir while the fan blows air at the surface. This will dry and cool beans quickly. One of the reasons that I have come to usually make mixed grain and bean tempeh is that by cooking the grain dry, using just one volume of water to each volume of grain, I can use the grain to dry the beans. To do this, add the cooked dry grains to the cooked beans and stir to mix thoroughly while everything is still piping hot. The surface moisture on the beans will absorb into the still thirsty grains. I also often add a little seaweed, snipped with scissors into small, dry strips that also absorb water from the beans. It is essential that the tempeh mix be no warmer than body temperature when you culture, or heat may kill your starter. A fan, used in conjunction with stirring, will greatly speed cooling. So will spreading the beans and/or grains to expose more surface area. Once the mix reaches body temperature, add your starter. The amount of starter you need varies with the source of the starter. Most commercial sources recommend 1 teaspoon or 5 milliliters of starter per pound, dry weight, of beans and/or grains. But if the source you use recommends a different proportion, follow that. If you use live tempeh rather than spores as a starter, use starter at a proportion of roughly 15% of substrate. Stir starter in thoroughly. Be sure as you stir to scrape the edges of the bowl and mix everything together. I like to rotate the bowl with my left hand as I stir with my right hand. If you are low on starter, you can compensate by putting extra time into stirring and maximizing beans and grain surfaces coming into contact with the starter. Don't mix so much that the beans overcool. They should still feel warm when you wrap them for incubation. Once the starter is thoroughly mixed into the substrate, it is time to transfer it into wrappings that will contain the developing tempeh. Banana and other large leaves are the traditional wrappings in Java. If you have access to banana trees or other large edible leaves, try making some tempeh in them. Gently fold leaves around the tempeh mix and secure with twine. Plastic bags perforated with tiny holes are the typical wrappings in tempeh production in the West. Use a needle, an ice pick, or a fork to make small holes every inch or so. If you make tempeh frequently, you may prefer to use Tupperware or other plastic food containers as tempeh forms by poking holes in them. I also frequently incubate tempeh in stainless steel trays, sometimes trays with holes in the bottoms and sides, with the tops of the trays covered with perforated aluminum foil, waxed paper, or plastic wrap. People can be quite creative with tempeh forms. In his high humidity incubator, Kalen made a gorgeous batch of tempeh in a basket. Sculpting with tempeh. Betty Steckmeyer. You can take young squares, 3/4-inch sandwich bag size, of tempeh, unwrap, slice, and build Lincoln log style with the slices. Return to the incubator and the overlap area will bind the basket or house together. I built a turkey once. You can also incubate the inoculated tempeh and stir it periodically to keep the mycelium from binding. At around 16 hours, you can make forms from the loose fuzzy beans, such as a bird's nest in a bowl, or a protein pie shell by lining a pie plate with partially done beans, with the next size smaller to press a form. The partially done tempeh also makes a good substrate to mix in robust seasonings that would otherwise inhibit mold growth, such as chorizo seasoning. Incubation needs to be closely monitored. In the early period, the rhizopus mold gains a strong competitive advantage over fungal and bacterial competitors from a relatively warm environment, and in fact has been shown to grow fastest at body temperature, 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit or 37 degrees Celsius. It's good to encourage rapid mold growth because the mold creates substances that protect it against certain bacteria, specifically gram-positive and anaerobic spore formers, state Heseltine and Wang. But once the mold is vigorously growing, after about 8 to 14 hours, depending upon temperature, it begins to generate significant heat, and the potential exists for heat to accumulate to the point where it kills the mold above body temperature. Therefore, tempeh is typically incubated at more moderate temperatures of 80 to 90 degrees Fahrenheit, or 27 to 32 degrees Celsius. The fact that molds generate heat midway through their incubation is a critical concept for understanding the dynamics of growing mold cultures. It is helpful to monitor incubator heat at frequent intervals through the incubation period in order to make adjustments, such as propping the door open, turning off the heat source, or manually fanning in order to avoid overheating. Like most ferments, there is no objective moment when the fermentation is complete. Tempeh has been formed once the mycelium growth is dense enough to hold the beans and/or grains together in a cohesive mat. Fresh tempeh has a yeasty or slightly mushroomy aroma and flavor. Typically, it is considered ripe when the first signs of sporulation, dark patches, begin to appear. In perforated containers, sporulation begins at the perforations, where airflow is greatest and the surface becomes driest. As sporulation proceeds, the tempeh develops a stronger aroma and flavor, tinged with ammonia, like a ripe cheese. The Javanese consider tempeh at various stages of sporulation to be distinct delicacies and savor them. My French friend Luca loves to eat overripe tempeh raw. He says it reminds him of camembert cheese. At ambient temperatures and even in the refrigerator, tempeh can continue to ferment, darkening with sporulation and developing an intensifying ammonia aroma and flavor. Traditionally, tempeh is eaten and sold fresh and considered highly perishable. In other words, this ferment is definitely not a strategy for preservation. Much of the tempeh produced for resale in the West is frozen, and in many cases pasteurized by steaming prior to freezing. In my own practice, I always eat some tempeh fresh, as soon as I remove it from the incubation chamber. Then I store in the fridge only as much as I think will be eaten within a few days, taking care to not stack the tempeh, as that enables the mold to continue growing in the center of the stack where heat is retained, but rather spreading them around the refrigerator with maximum surfaces exposed to cool air. To store it beyond a few days, I freeze the remainder of each batch, again taking care to spread out rather than stack the tempeh pieces. Once the tempeh is frozen, it can be stacked for space-efficient storage. Well-wrapped tempeh can be stored in a freezer for at least 6 months. Cooking with tempeh. Many people have no idea what to do with tempeh. In Indonesia, it is typically cut into thin strips and fried, cubed and incorporated into coconut milk, curry stews, or barbecued in sweet sauces. Often the strips are soaked before frying in a simple saltwater brine, sometimes spiced, sometimes with tamarind, or in other marinades. Some people like to steam the tempeh prior to marinating and frying to make sure the tempeh cooks thoroughly. I usually do not. I very much enjoy tempeh marinated in sweet, sour, salty sauces, mixing honey or another sweetener, vinegar and/or sauerkraut juice, miso and/or tamari, and sometimes hot sauce. I learned a new tempeh marinade I love from Ken Albala's Beans: A History. Mix salt, garlic, and coriander seeds and pound together into a paste in a mortar. Mix with water and marinate slices of tempeh in it. I usually fry tempeh in coconut oil or butter, though the one time I fried it in schmaltz, chicken fat, and called it chicken fried tempeh, it was a big hit. If I'm cooking tempeh for a crowd, I'll often marinate blocks of tempeh, oven fry the whole blocks, and then slice after cooking to make life easier. As described earlier, when I've had batches of tempeh that don't bind well, usually due to overheating, I like to crumble it into chili or sloppy joe type concoctions. William Shurtleff and Akiko Aoyagi's The Book of Tempeh, the definitive English language book on tempeh, is filled with recipes. Vegetarian cookbooks and the internet are other great sources. Ode to Tempeh. Spiky. Tempeh, like a homegrown tomato, resembles its bland supermarket cousin in name only. Homemade, it is sublime. Freshly incubating tempeh fills the kitchen with its warm aroma, like bread baking in an oven. A hungry crowd will gather, salivating, waiting for it to be sliced up and served. I love tempeh. When I am packaging up new tempeh for my friends, I sing the John Lennon song, Beautiful Boy, but I sing tempeh in the chorus instead of boy. Tempeh seduces me, and it always satisfies, no matter how it's cooked. My love affair with tempeh has, alas, left me equivocal about tofu, as if tofu were a regrettable high school crush I'd prefer to leave behind. Tempeh is so good that I crave it. I make gigantic batches of it. I want it for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. A kitchen with fresh tempeh is truly a blessed kitchen. When Sandor and I started making tempeh together a few winters ago, we were experimenting with a new incubator, and thus making large batches on a regular basis. The resulting abundance allowed us and our fellow cooks at Short Mountain freedom to experiment. It being winter, I was cooking warm, thick, starchy foods, and I noticed that tempeh made a great companion to the meals I was already preparing. I laid butter-fried tempeh between my hash browns and runny eggs at breakfast. For lunch, I'd hash up some crumbly tempeh, spritz it with tamari, and sprinkle it inside a quesadilla. Potatoes brought out tempeh's nuttiness, and sweet potatoes highlighted its savoriness. Creamy mashed potatoes were infinitely improved with tempeh mixed in, or laid on top. A slice of tempeh could be lowered into the buttery yawn of a baked sweet potato. In Indonesian cuisine, tempeh is often fried or deep-fried, or simmered in a soup, with companions like hot peppers, coconut milk, lemongrass, and tamarind. Almost always, it accompanies rice. One preparation calls for steaming mashed-up tempeh and coconut in banana leaves. Another marinates the tempeh overnight in a sweet sauce, then grills it in chunks on a shish kebab. Here in Tennessee, tempeh complements the full spectrum of our summer garden: yellow squash, green beans, basil, tomatoes, peppers, cabbage. I like to throw our summer harvest into a wok and stir-fry it with tempeh, coconut milk, and green curry paste. In some vegetarian cookbooks, you'll find tempeh doctored up to replace bacon or steak. That is all well and good if you pine for meat, but homemade tempeh is so superb, so magnificent a food, so rich with its own flavors, that there is no reason to mock it up like something else. Liberate yourself from meat mockery. Experiment. Throw it into the mix of whatever you're already cooking.